This is the Tan Talk Radio Network.
With a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. I am so happy to welcome to Joy on Paper, Delia Efron. She is the author of one of my favorite books, Syracusa, and I've been looking forward to talking to her about that book and all of her other books. Most of you will know her from the films that she's written, including You've Got Mail, The Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants, Hanging Up, and Michael. She comes from a very famous, unbelievably famous, writing family, the Efrons. I am so happy to have her here on the program today so we can talk about her career, and we'll also talk about her family. I am so happy to welcome you, Delia, to the program.
Thank you, Patsy. I'm happy to be here.
Wow, this is a thrill for me. I've sort of overwhelmed. Since I started this program 7 years ago, I've had the opportunity to talk to so many of my favorite authors, including 11 Mystery Writer of America Grandmasters and the Poet Laureate of the United States. But I think I'm most thrilled by being able to talk to you.
Oh, goodness, thank you. thank you very much.
There are so many reasons why, and before I started this program, I was, of course, a great reader. I had read thousands of books. And as I was doing this program, new authors would come to me, or people just starting to write, and they'd say, well, what should I do? How should I write? And I would always tell them, paint a picture. If you can paint a picture so that I can see it in my head, and if I see it, particularly if I see it as a movie, you've done your job. Well, with you, of course, your writing is so cinematic, and that comes, that's a genetic thing now, I think, with you. But you do that. You paint a picture. And I always tell up-and-coming authors, I say, read Syracusa, because it will show you how to be observant. And I think when I read that book for years, I mean, I've always been observant, but that book, more than anything, made me really think about thinking.
Yeah, it was really interesting how I ended up writing that book, because it's a novel, and I do all different forms, and I was nonfiction as well as fiction, and I was in Syracusa, which is it's so ancient, and it's all stone. It's really almost preserved. The Romans, around the beginning of AD, they invaded the place, and they knocked all the trees down, and the thing has just been paved over. And so it's tiny little street, and it's a stone paradise, and it's very preserved from the past. And the first day I was there, it has the most gorgeous, center plaza. But the first day I was there, I thought, well, this is the most beautiful place I've ever been. And the next day I thought, if I don't get out of here soon, I'm going to go mad. And I knew immediately from those two feelings that there was a book. Because I do think vacationing with couples, when we were vacationing with another couple at that time, is a very intense thing. And I had always wanted to write a book about marriage, and I suddenly thought, this is where it happens. This is where everything goes crazy. Because I think marriage, well, I think it's one of the great things, but it is also, as one of my therapists once said to me, it's falling in love across a crowded room is two neuroses spotting their own perfect neurotic match. And that just stuck with me over the years. A very Freudian sort of thing to say, I think. And I had often thought that marriage, as great as it is we all know if we're in it, there's a certain madness in it. And I just knew Syracusa was the place for everything to go crazy. So I knew I'd found my home for this first story, a sort of chilling psychological story about marriage. But I think that happens to writers. You're someplace, and it suddenly goes, oh, the light bulb goes off. This is where it is.
Well, you know, now I was in Sicily for the filming of Ashanti, Peter Ustinov, Omar Sharif movie. Mm-hmm. And it was my first entry into the film business. And I was really just a gopher. A friend invited me and got me into there. I got a taste of the film business. And then I had some time to go around the island and travel. When I got to Syracuse, I also found it so strange and so exotic. I mean, really, and so clean. The streets were so clean. It was wonderful when I got your book and I started reading it. And I thought, oh, my goodness, you brought it all back to me. And then this whole idea of the two couples traveling, mm-hmm. and it's told is in four voices. I think it's brilliant.
Thank you.
Everything about it, I was so taken with the book. And like, you can be a long trail in the forest and tell us more about how you came out with the idea of the four characters. I think they're so perfect.
You know, once you start a book, it's like there's a kind of thing where you suddenly know your head is going to become completely inhabited by it for at least a year or more. And so there's a resistance at the beginning to sort of almost to get pulled in, because it's going to take you over in that way. And this one, I mean, you know, there's a lot of stuff in it, like the literary couple in New York. I mean, you know, I've been in this world, not, you know, intensely in it, but I've been a book writer for years. So, I mean, I have a real sense of that world. So two characters came out of there, and then I'd vacationed a lot in Maine, so I knew that area, too, and I thought, well, that's perfect. And the other couple, you know, I wanted them to have history, but not to be always together as a friendship, but a friendship that friends sometimes do, that they meet places when they don't live in the same place. I've spent years traveling with my friends from Wales, and I live in New York. So we would have these amazing vacations together, and we got so close to them, but I never had them in my life in a way I just have regular friends. So I think travel is a very powerful place for things to heat up.
Well, we have the New York couple, Lizzie and Michael, and it is such a interesting coupling of these two people, both writers. Tell us really about these two, how you looked at them when you came out with the idea. Which character actually did you come up with first, Lizzie or Finn?
You know, what I do before I start is I know the history of each couple before they appear on the page. So I do a lot of, I think probably Lizzie was probably where I started because she's closest to me, but I probably started with Lizzie and Michael, and then, well, I'm not sure if I did that actually, because I always thought of it as a four character piece. It's just that I have to do a lot of research before I start. So when I had to go back to Syracuse, not as a vacationer, but as a real, you know, writer doing research. And I had to, and I got the names of some people just by luck. I mean, certain amount of writing a book like this, you know, is luck. And one of the people, Alex Yarsky, this marvelous architect who had grown up in Poland and studied architecture in London, so she was fluent in English. And then she married a Syracusan architect, and she lived in Syracuse, so she knew everything. And someone gave me her name. And, you know, Syracuse is a small place. If somebody comes there, it's an adventure for everybody. So Alex was so generous with her knowledge. And I don't know why I ever thought I could set a book in a place I knew absolutely nothing about. If I hadn't met Alex, I don't think I could have written the book, you know? Sort of right in the middle of it, I'm floating around a little lost when my characters are about... There's nothing worse than the third act of the second act of a book when you're like just past the halfway point. And she had gotten a special grant to study architecture at Harvard, so she's doing graduate work there. And so I live in New York, so I went up to Boston for a weekend, and we just spread all my photos out on the ground, and I told her what was going on in the book, and she would tell me where that might take place or why that wouldn't take place there, or, you know, that, I mean, you get a lot of help when you do a book And I guess some people don't. I mean, everybody has a different route. But in this case, since I was setting this in Sicily, not even in Italy, you know, really, Sicily's a very specific place. If I had not met Alex, I don't think I could have written the book.
Well, I'm so glad you did, because I think it is so perfect in many respects from as a scene. You know, we always talk about a city becoming a character in a book. But in this case, it really becomes a character.
It's critical. I know. It's very magical there, and in its both in its threatening qualities and its enticing qualities. And when I went to finish it up, my husband was very sick then, my late husband Jerry, and I went with my best friend, who's a novelist who lives in England, and so to just double check everything and make sure I got everything right, you know. And you know, we got there. She'd never been, and she looked around and she said to me, "Oh, I am." She's a novelist. She said, "I am so jealous you found this place first, because it's just such a specific and mysteriously divine place."
It is. And you, of course, I spoke to you in 2016 when the book first came out. As a matter of fact, I'd only started the program in 2015. So I was new at this. I had never been on radio. I started from, you know, not knowing anything. And I think even then I was afraid of you. I was afraid of all the authors I was talking to in those days.
Well, what a brave thing to do this show then.
You know, it was because I got the idea. Actually, I got the idea one morning at 4 o'clock in the morning when I was driving to the hospital. My husband had had some surgery. And I got the idea because I was listening to an interview with an author, and I realized that the interviewer had not ever read the book and didn't know the author, and I knew the author very well. I knew all his books, and I got the idea. I said, well, I have to talk to authors, and within a few weeks, I was on the radio, quite by, actually by accident, but I've had this great joy of being able to talk to so many authors that I admire, and when I talk to you, I was a nervous wreck. I had actually, I don't know if I mentioned it at the time, I was in Hollywood in like 82, 83, around that period of time. And I actually had three of my spec scripts were optioned.
Good for you.
And they appeared in the Hollywood Reporter, full page ad, which I was so, of course, proud of at the time. And I'm so glad it happened because my father lived to see that. Because, of course, they went into turnaround. So,
well, of course, everything does.
You know, so you know that, of course, you don't, that doesn't happen to you, but
it happens to everybody.
Well, but I did, you know, have that opportunity, and I did get to meet Nora twice, sort of parties. I think one was a political party. And again, I was younger, and I was like, I was so enthralled and so excited. I think I sort of blurbed something like, I think you're wonderful or something like that. So,
nice.
You know, but with you, when I got Syracuse, and I just, at that point, I'd been started getting questions from people. How do I write? How can I paint a picture? You know, when I say paint a picture, I said, well, get Syracuse, for goodness sakes, if you want to know. And one of the things, I remember one of the scenes that I love in the book, we have to explain, there are four adults in the book, and then there's one of the couple has a daughter named Snow. And Snow adds a very special dynamic to the entire story. But I love the part in the forum where you write about the gladiators. It was so eye-opening to me. You talked about the gladiators, and many people would write about the gladiators and how they, you know, the pretend gladiators and, you know, entertaining the tourists. But you talk about how they felt in the morning when they left the house. And I had never...
They put on their gladiator.
Yeah. I thought it was so brilliant. I thought, you know, I never thought of the process. I never thought of, even though I've read, you know, thousands of books, somehow that just hit me. I thought, wow, this is so clever. And then one after another, there are just so many lines in your book. I don't know, you know, do they just come to you, these ideas? I kept thinking of Shakespeare.
You know, I always say, you know, interesting you tell writers to paint a picture. Of course, when you write, you need to do that. I always say, write from your heart. because your writing is your fingerprint, and no one can tell your stories your way. So you have to find out what your stories are, and then you have to go about writing them, which involves, you know, a lot of stuff, you know, research and thinking a lot about your characters and who they might be and what they have read and what their favorite songs are and what their favorite movies are. I mean, you just have to go into a really intense thing to understand your characters. But it is, the story needs to be personal. It needs to come, everything does. And so I think when you say that, you know, I mean, one of the things I realized when I started writing, I think probably when I wrote this 500-word piece called How to Eat Like a Child, that was just a deadpan thing about how children need food, and the New York Times published it, and I was down to practically my last dollar, and I thought, you know, I can't be a writer. I'm going to have to go find something else to do, and the thing came out, and it was an overnight, you know, enormous success, and I was offered a book contract the next day, and my life changed. But nobody would have written that weird little piece about, you know, I was sitting there eating chocolate pudding one night, and I just looked at the way I was eating it, and I thought, I'm still eating it like a child. I was making a little hole in the skin and scooping the pudding out from underneath, and I just wrote this deadpan thing about how children need food. And, you know, nobody, that's me. That's some crazy thing that I am. And I thought, when I looked at that piece, I thought, oh, I get children. That's something I understand. I've heard my own voice for the first time, and I think as a writer what you have to do is find your voice, and that is like going to your heart. What are your stories? What interests you? What is it you understand about life that that you think you do as well as someone else or better? What are your passions? And I think that's always the way to go.
Well, the tremendous success of How to Eat Like a Child was, I mean, it was enormous. When you think about it, this simple idea, and you use that for Lizzie, for her big success.
I did.
You know, where she, you know, Michael, of course, talks about how Lizzie wrote a simple, about businessmen.
She writes a very simple thing, and he immediately notices that she has an eye.
Yeah.
Yeah, she notices things, and that's how he gets interested in her, yes. That's true.
It was a pivotal point, because that...
Yeah, absolutely. I did use that.
Yeah, you used it.
I didn't realize it, but I did, yes, absolutely.
Yeah. And that was, I thought that was so good when I, of course, when I read the book, I immediately knew that you had used it. This wonderful, how incredible, you know, that your success, really the turning point in your writing career, came from a simple thing where you simply were talking about something that you understood.
Yeah, right. Exactly. That, I mean, there I was just eating chocolate pudding. I write this deadpan thing, and it suddenly hits a nerve. Of course, I was so young and so naive, I thought, oh, my God, everything I write will have this kind of power. But, of course, nothing else has quite the power of How to Eat Like a Child. It was really something. So that was wonderful. I wondered, because I didn't really realize we were going to talk about Syracuse. I mean, do you know that I have a new book out that... called Left on 10th, which has just been on the New York Times bestseller list. Are you aware of that?
I'm aware of that, and I haven't gotten it yet. And I had actually, I had contacted your publicist and publisher, and I had tried to book you directly, like I do nowadays. I mostly go through publishers nowadays. And I wasn't on anybody's list. Although I was on the list in 2016.
Yeah, no. I mean, of course, I just didn't realize that, because I've been talking endlessly about Left on 10th, so I was just really very surprised that that we're talking about Syracuse, which is wonderful.
Well, I wanted to talk about Syracuse because it's the one that I recommend. You know.
Mm-hmm.
Because I know it so well, and because I point to specific areas of the book or specific sections that I think people should read, writers, you know, when they're starting off, they really are all over the place, and they're trying to get advice from this and that and this. And I always tell them, you have to just read well. You have to read books where the author has this wonderful ability to take you to a place. And
yeah, I think that's true.
That's what you do with Syracuse.
Thank you.
So, but you want to talk about the new book? Tell me about the new book, because I have not read it, though.
Well, Left Untenth is a memoir about 4 years of my life when just about everything that could happen to me did happen to me. It's about losing my husband of 32 years, and it starts that night, and then it's about a year alone, and so it's about death and loneliness, and then my internet crashes, and I write a piece about it, and as a result, I get a letter from Peter, whom I met 54 years before, and do not remember, but I get a letter from him and an email, and we start to correspond, and then we absolutely fall madly in love. So it's about love again. It's all the letters are in there between us, and then it's just a very magical thing. Because there was so much crazy synchronicity with, I mean, first my internet crashes, and that's why he ends up writing me, because I write a piece about in the New York Times about it, and he finds out that, in fact, I am, in fact, a widow. I hate that word. It's so sexless. But anyway, that's what he finds out. And then about 2 months before that, I had been invited to speak at a conference of Jungians, you know, followers of Carl Jung, in Texas. And the first line of his thing is, I'm a Jungian analyst, a psychiatrist living in the Bay Area. And I thought, oh, my God, a Jungian has come to my door. And then his last trip had been to Sicily, to Syracuse, with his late wife.
Oh, my goodness.
So that was also just simply shocking. And we started, I mean, there were so many strange coincidences, so we started to communicate. Anyway, we fell madly in love. And then 4 months later, I got diagnosed with AML, a very severe leukemia. And we got married in the hospital, and I went through a couple years of really intense chemotherapy. Ultimately, I had a bone marrow stem cell transplant, which meant I was in the hospital 100 days, and he was a total hero. He was there every single minute, and I survived. So it's about survival, love again, survival, medicine. It's even about dogs, and it's about friendship because of all my women warriors, all my best friends just carried me through, as well as Peter. So it's a very emotional story.
Well, of course, I was aware of it. I haven't read it. Although I did write to the publishers, am I getting booked? And then finally, that's when I decided, I didn't hear back from anybody, so I decided to just contact you directly, because I've been wanting to talk about Syracuse. Mm-hmm. But isn't this wonderful that he had been to Syracuse too?
Oh, yeah. No, it was amazing.
I mean,
it was the last trip. He's friends with someone who's an expert in, this is really wild what people can be experts in, it, in earthquakes. And there was this giant earthquake in Noto, which is just south of Syracuse, where the whole town went down practically, and they rebuilt it all. Like, it's the whole place is just rebuilt the years after this earthquake. And anyway, they went with, he's a good friend of his, so he and his late wife went to Syracuse with this man who knew everyone in Syracuse as well as everyone in Noto, and that was their last trip together before she got sick. So
was he aware of your book?
He had loved Syracuse. He'd read my book, which he absolutely loved. So Syracuse played a role in many ways in our getting together.
Wow. That's one of the things I've discovered here since I've done the program, these magical sort of golden threads that connect me to authors and connect me to places.
Yeah, that's true. In fact, my book, which is called Left on 10th, I live on 10th Street in Greenwich Village, so it's also about a place as well as anything. I think of it as Left on 10th is my way home, but also I was left on 10th when Jerry died, and then life took all these left turns that I did not expect. So Left on 10th is very metaphorical for me. But it's also about a place. It's about Greenwich Village. And
you know,
it's the underpinnings of that book, too.
I wanted to get the book from the publisher. It came out back in April. And my husband passed away 2 years ago on July 4th.
Oh, my goodness. So, I'm so sorry.
And so it's been an emotional time, this whole sort of April, May, June, July, you know,
sure.
You go through the
of use, at least from the letters I've been getting from all sorts of people who've experienced loss.
It's funny you mention you have love letters, because one of the things that my husband, before he passed away, he said to me, you don't have any love letters from me.
No.
And I said, Well, no, I don't think so, because we haven't been apart. And he sort of realized, for 43 years, we were almost never apart from the...
Oh, my goodness, you know, that's terribly difficult, Patsy.
We were together all the time, except for a few camping trips with the boys in the middle of nowhere. And it was funny that he would say that, because I had never thought of that. I certainly never thought of that. But he thought of that at the end, near the end. He said, "You don't have any love letters."
Hmm.
Life is strange, isn't it?
Yes, very.
You know, these things happen. So.
And how have you been doing then?
Well, you know, it's a day-to-day thing,
as you know, sure.
It's not easy. One of the reasons that I'm able to do this, though, is that he's a pilot. He was in the Israeli Air Force, and he's a pilot. You know, and later on, we had our own plane, and we flew a lot. And so he loved flying, of course. And before he passed away, he said, "Well, don't worry. My program is on Tuesdays and Thursdays." And so he said, "Every Tuesday and Thursday from 11 to 12, I'm flying over the studio."
Oh, that's the sweetest thing I've ever heard.
And so so I come to the studio, and I sit outside for half an hour beforehand, just looking up at the sky, knowing that he's going to be there for me. Mm-hmm. Because he was so proud. You know, this is one of the wonderful things. It is so funny. I've been reading since I was three. Would get books, buy books all the time, wherever we lived. We met actually in Iran. He's Israeli. I'm American. It's a complicated thing. But wherever I was always buying books and buying books and buying books and buying books. And he was really always, you know, at first he didn't understand. And then later on, he would, you know, whenever there was a bookstore, it didn't matter where, if we were driving, he'd put on the brakes. And, you know, he was very indulgent to the point that at one point I had over 6,000 books.
Really? Good gracious. Had you read them all?
Yes, of course. Oh, yes. I read them all. And so I didn't know why I was doing it. And really, until this idea for the radio program came, I didn't know why I had been doing this all these years.
Mm-hmm.
And then it all happened. And now I have this wonderful thing to keep me going, this knowledge that he's listening, and he loves me, that I am helping to promote books and encourage people to read, because he could read in many languages. So he was very proud that I did this. So,
I'm sure.
You know, and so now I have this opportunity to talk to my favorite authors.
He sounds like a very warm, supportive husband.
Oh, he was. He was. Amazing. And I was blessed. And so I do this program mostly, I think, for him now, because I know that he was so proud of me.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that happens here is that you're inspiring, and your story here of what you've done now with the new book, Left on 10th, A Second Chance at Life. And the wonderful thing about, that's why I named this program Joy on Paper, because you get such a joy out of writing, and then you get such a joy out of reading.
Yeah, that's lovely.
And let's talk a little bit about your family background, because my listeners who aren't aware of it will be truly amazed by your parents and sisters.
Well, you know, I grew up in Beverly Hills. My parents were screenwriters. They were a writing couple, my mother and father. And my mother, it was in the 50s, I guess, when, you know, it was very rare for women to be professional in the way that my mother was. And she was I did not have any friends whose mothers worked at that time. And so my mother was very proud of the fact that she had this career. And it was honestly the main message to us is she had four daughters, and the main message she gave us is you must have a career. She never talked about getting married. She never talked about having children. She would often say things like elope. So she wasn't in any way she never took me shopping for clothes. She would just send us all off together to do some shopping. I mean, the kids. There was, I mean, I think the last time I remember going into a store with her for clothes was when I was like 5 years old. I mean, she was a very, her focus was that she would have raised these young women to be career women, but also, I think, more than anything, she, my father and her, they just wanted us to be writers. And every time I said something funny, my dad shouted, "That's a great line, write it down." And every time I said something that sounded like a title, he'd say, "That's a great title." So I had titles before I had books. And I learned at the dinner table about storytelling. We played word games, charades and things like that, 20 questions, you know, all sorts of... It was a very lively home in terms of... I mean, it's not an accident that all four of us became writers. There was almost nothing else that they would have even considered acceptable. And so my sister Nora, who was just, you know, who's such a well-known writer and director, she really was like shot out of the cannon. I mean, there was like, she became that person almost from the day she was born. And the rest of us all took longer to accept it because, first of all, my parents were successful movie writers, and then my sister was so successful. So then I didn't really... I wrote How to Eat Like a Child when I was like 32. I figured out I wanted to be a writer by about when I was 28. I knew at that moment if I didn't become it, I wouldn't become it. And it was the first time I realized that life wasn't going to go on forever. And I thought, you better do something. You better do something you want to do. And so I decided to take my money, and I had enough money to last 2 years. I lived really cheaply, and I would either be a writer at the end of that time or I wouldn't. And I was just about the end of that time. I mean, really, it was down to like $500. And when I wrote How to Eat Like a Child, I knew I had to sell to the New York Times if I wanted to be a writer then. You know, I knew it was the only place I was going to get noticed.
And so you did.
And that's what I did. But then my sister Amy, she became a writer sort of in her 30s. And my sister Hallie, not till she was 40. She's a successful mystery writer, Hallie. And so in the end, you know, we all became writers, and we were raised to it.
Well, of course, your parents, Phoebe and Henry Efron, wrote many, many movies that are so famous and people will immediately recognize. My favorite of their writing, I love Desk Set.
Except with Tracy and Hepburn. And I guess I watched the other night, I watched Daddy Long Legs, which I hadn't seen in years, which with Leslie Caron and Fred Astaire. And they did No Business Like Show Business with Marilyn Monroe, saying, you know, we're having a heat wave. Pretty great moment. Anyway, so, you know, they were, at that time, in what would be called Hollywood, writers were hired by studios and just... given one movie after another. So many more movies were made then. And you could literally just go from one to the next, You didn't have to go in and pitch or anything. You were like a contract writer. They had an office at 20th Century Fox, and they loved it. They really loved it. And that's unusual. You know, most screenwriters are not the happiest people on the planet, so because they get you can get fired. I mean, if you write a book, no one can fire you. It's your book. You own the copyright. But if you write a movie, as you know, because you've written them, you know, the minute they buy your movie, you don't own it anymore.
You don't own it.
Yeah. And so therefore, they can just say, well, you know, make the airplane pilot a truck driver. Or, you know, oh, we don't want to set it in L.A., set it in New York. I mean, they can tell you a million things to do that you might not want to do, and they can also simply just fire you and hire someone else to do it. So it's a frustrating world. It's exciting and wonderful in many ways, but it is also a frustrating world. And I realized immediately in it that I needed to have a book career at the same time because I felt I wouldn't know what my voice was. I wouldn't be able to tell my own stories my way. So I very carefully crafted a career in which I could move between. I'm always telling screenwriters, do something else, write a play, write a book, just cushion it in some way, because you'll give yourself more years and you'll make yourself happier. But, you know, some people, just, I mean, some writers are meant to write films. They're not meant to write other things. You know, it's not like you can just decide you're going to write in another form.
But I think it's easier for film writers to write a book than for novelists to write a script.
I don't really know if that's true. I mean, I really don't. You know, I just think it varies from person to person, because once you understand the rules of drama, you know, that's what you need to understand to write a screenplay more than you do to write a book.
Did you ever go to any of the filming in Hollywood of your parents' movies?
Did I ever go where?
Being made, of your parents' films.
Yeah, yes, I did. I certainly did. I certainly went to No Business Like Show Business. I remember meeting Marilyn Monroe. She was wearing a robe, and her hair was in curlers with a little scarf around it. And I was with two of my sisters. I was with Nora and Hallie, and my father said, "This is Nora, Delia, and Hallie." And she said, "Hi, Nora, Delia, and Hallie." She patted each of us on the head. My mother was fanatic about the fact that we were not allowed to ask anyone for autographs. She would say to us, "They are no better than you are. Do not worship them. They are no better than you are. You're not allowed to ask for autographs." And, I mean, she had just more opinions, my mother, than anyone, and they were never what everyone else thought. So we lived by her rules. So that was the thing. But it was really fun to go on.
Well, maybe it reminds me a little bit of Taylor's mother in Syracuse. Her mother has opinions.
Yes. That's true. That's true.
I love her opinions. I love...
Oh, yeah, I know. Well, yes, my mother would not have been like that, though. Taylor's mother's all about appearance, and my mother wasn't at all about that. Say things to me when I was, like, eight, like, pick one hairdo and stick to it. You know, things that had no, she had no understanding of. And she was quite a chic woman, but she, you know, in her own way. But she didn't have interest in makeup or, I don't know, fashion. She dressed beautifully, but she wasn't into fashion. She had her own style, and she stuck to it.
And then, of course, on your own films, how often did you spend time on the set?
Oh, well, that was the great joy of working with Nora, is that, of course, and one of the reasons she wanted me to collaborate with her when she directed her first movie was she wanted someone on the set that she could trust and who would she could confide in and who would tell her what she needed to know that she didn't realize. So I was the perfect person for that. She always used to say we share half a brain. And so we began collaborating. It was very strange to be collaborating when our parents collaborated, because it's like, look how far we've come. We're right back in the same place. But it was great fun to be on the set. And that first movie, This Is My Life, which is based on a Meg Wolitzer book called This Is Your Life, and it starred Julie Kavner and Gabby Hoffman, and it was kind of, it was just so wonderful. It was so exciting every day, and there was so much laughter and fun. And the other wonderful thing about being on the set, because you rehearse a scene so that you can figure out if there are things that you need to change that day, and that's very thrilling. But also, there is just, it's when everyone comes together. It's when the designers come on and the costume people come on, and it becomes a real thing. And mostly writers aren't welcome on sets, so I got to always be involved with that. And then also I would be involved in the editing afterwards. I could go in the editing room. So I got to really have a very full, you know, plate as a screenwriter that I'm just so grateful to Nora for.
Well, of course, I think nobody in Hollywood would object to an Efron being on stage.
No, you have no idea. I mean, really, it is not a place that welcomes the writer.
Oh, no, I know. I wasn't.
Right.
You know, when... And I adapted a few books to, you know, the terrible thing is, generally speaking, the scripts go through so many hands that at the end they're hardly recognizable. But I think you had probably had more control over your work.
Well, yes. I mean, when Nora and I were working together, I think we did. We we both did have more control, but, you know, not always, because, well, I mean, we did, but you need the backing of good producers, and you need to have made a lot of the right decisions or casting. It's very easy for a movie. There's so many decisions to get made, and, you know, it's very easy for a movie to sort of not work. I think the miracle is when they do work.
Oh, like You've Got Mail.
Do. I mean, I'm fond of all our movies for one reason or another.
Well, they're all great, but, of course, You've Got Mail is one of my favorites. I love it.
Oh, thank you. Well, that's a real book person's movie, isn't it?
It is. Yeah, exactly. Anything. Well, I do. It is true. Any book that has a bookstore in it, I gravitate to.
Yeah.
You know, it's just the way we are. But what about one of your films, Hanging Up? I could never relate to it. I know it was a good movie, and for me that...
Actually, I don't think it is a good movie.
Well...
No, I mean, it was one of the best scripts ever. I mean, Diane Keaton directed it, and it was a bit of a heartbreak, but that's the reason why I write books, because I love that book, and that was my first novel, Hanging Up, and it's really special to me. And so if someone says, as you did, I don't really get it, I'd say go read the book.
Yeah, that's true. I was going to say that.
That's a great thing about, you know, writing a book.
I did not like the movie. No, I can be honest with you. I really didn't like the movie, but I love the book, and I love all your books. But it's so thrilling, really, when a writer can see when it works out, and you can see your book on film, and it's done right.
Yes, but you know, there's no question that a movie is not a book. And one of the things you have to do when you adapt is find the movie in the book. And but even so, I mean, I think that this was Diane's movie because the director controls everything. But it did not resemble in many ways my script. And not only that, Walter Matthau got very, very ill in it, and there were all sorts of scenes that couldn't be shot. So it had a lot of trauma associated with it. And that's just what it is. You know, a bunch of people collaborate. You just never know if the magic is going to work or not. And maybe for some people it does there, but, I understand what you're saying.
Well, you know, for me, as I said, it's such an honor to be able to talk to you. It's this whole connection of so many things that make this such a program that I really want writers and readers to just read more. I realize, for example, that in America, 50% of the people read only at an eighth grade level.
Mm.
I had no idea until recently that it was so bad. And so one of the things, of course, you've written for younger people too. How do you feel about writing for younger people?
You know, with me, if a story comes to me, I usually know what it is. Is it a story for adults? Is it a story for young people? I mean, it's not, you know, everything that you write has its own destiny, and those were just the stories that came to me, and some of them were for, I have a couple of YAs, and some of them are adult books, and some of them are nonfiction, and, you know, it's just how what you want to write about presents itself to you in your heart and your brain.
I hope that I don't know what you're writing next. In February, I had on my program Eugenia Lovett West. I don't know if you've ever met her. She's a New Yorker, mm-hmm. and she celebrated her 99th birthday on Joy on Paper.
Wow, fabulous.
And she had just finished a book on cybercrime. It's a mystery about an older woman who gets involved, somebody tries to scam her. And so she takes on cybercrime as a subject. And she's 99 years old and still
fabulous.
Writing, and really a fantastic, fantastic mystery.
Mm, how wonderful.
So that's a wonderful thing about being a writer, is that you can keep going.
Yeah, it's true.
So I hope that there's more books that you write more, and then next time make sure I'm on your publisher's list and I get the book in advance, because I love to get books in advance. I think that's one of the fun things. When my husband, when I started the program, after like the first month, we started getting these big boxes of books, and he said, oh my goodness, it's going to save a lot of money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because he realized that, you know, after buying 6,000 books over the years, mm-hmm. That I was getting these books free.
Yeah. That's nice.
So he got sort of a kick out of it. I hope that you're writing some more, and perhaps I hope I'll try to get a hold of Hallie. Do you think she'll talk to me?
I'm sure she'd love to.
Okay. Well, I'll talk to Hallie, and we'll talk more about her writing, because I, of course, read her mysteries, and I would love to talk to her. And again, for you, I want to thank you so much. I'm going to help promote this book, The Left on 10th, A Second Chance at Life. I will put that on my website and on my social media.
Thank
because
you. That's
I'm
wonderful.
And I will read it. I'm a little still a little bit emotional myself. So I'm, you know,
yeah,
it's
sure
it's a hard
will speak to you
hard subject,
okay.
But I'm sure it will. And with your brilliant writing.
It's also funny and very joyful.
That's what I
okay.
need. Well,
right.
Delia Efron, thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper. It is an honor to talk to you, a thrill. And I will have you back when you write a next book, okay?
Thank you, Patsy. Okay. I love being here.
Okay. Bye-bye now.
Take care. Bye.
Thanks. Okay. We're going to go straight to commercial.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Are you ready to eliminate your home energy bill? Well, get ready to harness the sun. Go EHS, Effective Solar Solutions, by Efficient Home Services. With no upfront costs, you can save money on your utility bill and even eliminate your electric bill altogether with EHS Solar. Call EHS, the number one solar installer nationwide. We know how to customize your home. EHS handles every project in-house with no subcontractors. Remember, no upfront costs, tax breaks, and the best company in the business, Efficient Home Services. Schedule an appointment today at 727-353-3757. Visit our website and download your free buyer's guide to going solar at www.goehs.com. Go solar, go savings, go EHS. Call 727-353-3757 today to talk to our experts.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at LarsonPatentLaw.com.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more rewarding careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to Toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Hi, this is Patsy with a Z, and I am back. Don't have much time, but we have time to play something. For all you writers out there who are sending me these messages, here is something from Jim Lamb. Oh.
What does Derek Zoolander have in common with Holden Caulfield? Or Wonder Woman with Jane Eyre? Each is a protagonist, a shining star, whether on the page, the stage, or silver screen. I'm Jim Lamb. Let's get started. When it comes to storytelling, protagonists stand in the spotlight. They are primary, numero uno, of chief importance, VIPs. What they do or say affects everything and everybody. What kind of characteristics do protagonists have? It varies. They might be strong, courageous, and honorable, but with a flaw. For example, in Raiders of the Lost Ark, Indiana Jones was definitely heroic, except when it came to, you know, snakes. What about Superman? Wow! Now there's a super-duper hero, right? Except for, you know, kryptonite. Hilary Swank won an Oscar for playing Maggie Fitzgerald in Million Dollar Baby. What a great performance. Except, spoilers, she dies in the end. How about Erin Brockovich? She's heroic in real life, as well as a movie. Not many people can do that. Plus, she's still alive. So let's see. Where were we? Oh yeah, protagonists are people, just like you and me. Except they're not. They run into danger while the rest of us flee. They take on the villain at high noon while we hide in the corner. And sometimes, in saving everyone else's life, they die. Like Natasha, aka Black Widow. What motivates protagonists? Many things. They might be seeking long-lost treasure, like Indiana Jones, or trying to save a family member, as John Wayne did in The Searchers. Or, like Ripley in Alien, they're fighting a horrible, slimy monster. Yuck. Protagonists live complicated lives. Something always goes wrong. There are obstacles, false starts, setbacks, betrayals, mistakes. Good plans go bad. Bad things get worse. So whether it's the witch in Wicked or Kermit in the Muppet movie, remember this. It isn't easy being green. I'm Jim Lamb, and you've just learned a little something-something about protagonists.
Okay, well, all of you people out there, keep writing. And this is what you will find. This is what why I named this program Joy on Paper. Because remember what I always tell you. One of the joys of life is to see your words on paper and then to hear your words in an audible book. Or if you are very, very lucky, to hear those magic words, lights, camera, action, and your book will be turned into a major motion picture, a streaming video, or a series on the Hallmark Channel. And you never know. It was so much fun to talk to them. Delia Ephron. And make sure that you say something nice to somebody, and I will say something nice to Big Ed. I am thankful for Big Ed. I am thankful for him all the time because he is so wonderful. And Ed saluted me, and I saluted him because I should have been a general. Oh, I would have been a great general, and I'd have a wonderful pension today. Well, gee, I missed it. Okay, bye-bye now.